Hello, OTV Land. Thanks for coming. In a minute, we're going to get started with Ryan and Nathan on divorce and Chapter 13 issues. But I want to give you a little preview of what we've got coming up. In August, and the date will be August 11th, we will have our two Chapter 13 trustees, Mary Grossman and Rebecca Garcia, and they're going to talk about different hot topics in the Chapter 13 area. So please come on back August 11th for Mary and Rebecca. We don't have anything yet for September and October, but we will be working on that. And if we can't come up with a topic, we'll just skip those months and then we'll be back on at the end of the year. We are going to do a date change in November. November we're having as an annual repeat of the Supreme Court review and preview. And it's Tom Schreiner and Pete Blaine, and they've agreed to make this an annual thing. And this year, of course, we had something like five or six Supreme Court cases. So definitely come on back in November. And again, there'll be a date change, and I'll give you that in an email. It's going to be November the 3rd. November the 3rd, so it's going to be like the first Tuesday rather than the second. And then December, we've got ethics with Mark Metz and Olivier Ryer and Paula's Cookies, and that's going to be December 8th. So we've got August, the Chapter 13 topic, with our trustees. Please come for that. I'm sure that's going to be great. And then nothing yet for September and October. We'll keep you posted. And then November and December with our annual repeats of the Supreme Court and then ethics. Get your ethics credit and your cookies in December. Don't forget. Okay, so today, this was a hot topic on the listserv, and I'm so glad these guys agreed to present it. We're talking about divorce and Chapter 13. Ryan and Nathan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Judge, and good morning. As Judge Kelly mentioned, we see this on the listserv quite a bit, and these cases can be very fact-specific. But we did want to have a conversation about this and stay in the Chapter 13 realm to lead up to next month's Lou Jones. And we are lucky because Nathan here does not only some bankruptcy work, but also family law, whereas I don't have any experience in that field. So we'll be looking to him for all the answers. And also we're hoping to have a conversation with the people here as well as those in the remote areas, if you'd like, on what you would do in the situations here. So we broke up the materials into two sections. The first are the hypotheticals. And then the others relate to the Wisconsin Model Rules of Ethics and the Chapter 13 rules. So again, our typical situation is we're filing a bankruptcy. We're going to say it's a Chapter 13 bankruptcy. It's going to be a standard husband and wife. And at some point during the plan, pre-confirmation, post-confirmation, month one, month 60, they or one of them comes to you and says, look, we're not going to be staying together. So when that case arises, we want to make sure that you're prepared with what your options are, what options are available to your clients, and what's the most ethical way to go about handling those.
Well, and the ethics part of it, I think, is something that is not always considered. There are some conflicts that you cannot waive, some you can. A lot of times attorneys think you can waive any conflict. That is not true. Even referring the parties to a divorce attorney, if you refer one spouse to one divorce attorney and don't refer the other spouse to a divorce attorney, you may be running awry there of some Supreme Court rules in terms of what ethics you have to concurrent clients. So that's something to take into consideration that a lot of attorneys don't. And the answer isn't always easy as to what you can do, what you can't do. So we have some fact patterns here that I know Ryan has got.
Absolutely. So the first fact pattern concerns husband and wife, and they're almost done with the bankruptcy. So Hermione and Ron are 52 months into their 60-month Chapter 13 plan. They're paying all their unsecured debt back, so they're probably high-income debtors, or maybe they just had a small amount of unsecured debt. All the secured debt, all the priority debt, taxes, and everything has been paid up. So all you're left with is unsecured debt here. they've all done the requisites to prepare for the discharge, except for the certifications at the end. And then we get an email from one person, in this case, Hermione, the wife, saying, do you know any lawyers who handle divorces, or wizard divorces in this case, if you're a Harry Potter fan? And then when you contact her back, and you learn that actually she went ahead and filed her bankruptcy and didn't, you know, bother to mention that to you initially.
Filed her divorce, you mean?
Yes, I'm sorry. So she filed her divorce, and she actually took the kids and moved in with her friends. So at this point, what do you do with respect to the bankruptcy? What are your options with the Chapter 13, and how do you even get the parties together to kind of plan out the last 8 months? What do you think?
Well, the first thing I do is in my, and to backtrack a little bit, in my retainer agreements, I have a specific section as to whether, you know, if the parties should get divorced or separated, I have the right to withdraw, because that can be a conflict. If their economic interests are not aligned and sometimes against each other, that can be an issue. So the first thing I do is, upon learning of the information, is I send both parties a letter, which sometimes can be an issue in and of itself. You'll have a spouse who files for a divorce and hasn't told the other spouse yet. That doesn't happen often, but I have a duty to both clients. So the first thing I do is send a letter out explaining that I have the right to withdraw pursuant to my retainer agreement. I explain the potential conflict in the letter. I request that each of them contact me within a certain period of days. Usually they make an office appointment and come in together, or the leech talk to me on the phone. I present them with the options of waiving that. Any potential conflict and that sort can be waived as long as they're well informed. Simply having them sign a waiver without them having being informed about the waiver and the pros and cons to waiving that, the Supreme Court ethics rules say that clients also have to be informed as to what conflict they are waiving and the pros and cons to that. So I try to have a conversation with each. If one party is not going to cooperate with me, does not get back to me, I have to withdraw from the case. However, it actually hasn't happened yet. Both parties usually call me right away. They don't want their case to be dismissed, or they don't want me to withdraw from the case. I think it can be difficult finding a debtor's attorney to take on a Chapter 13 case in the middle of a plan. So usually they call me right away. And also, one of the first questions I ask is, do you each have a lawyer? And I like to have a conversation with each lawyer. Usually the lawyers love to call me first, because that really, in a divorce, debt is a huge issue, and they want to know, is there going to be debt? What options exist? And Ryan can speak further specifically on the fact patterns as to conversion or what options exist here.
Sure, absolutely. So we're going to back up just a little. So Nathan mentioned something that maybe not everybody has in their agreement, which is laid out in advance, saying, we understand that Chapter 13 plan is a long-term plan. If something happens during this plan that would cause the situation to change, we have to address it, and I have the right to withdraw by filing a motion with the bankruptcy court, serving the creditors, and giving notice to everybody, making sure that they understand that I can't ethically go ahead and advance and represent you both, even if, you know, you're towards the end of this plan. Now, with the fact pattern here, again, the debtors are almost completed with the plan. They're paying off the majority of their debt, so it could actually be to their benefit to stay in the Chapter 13. We mentioned the Supreme Court and the ethical rules. On the relevant sections of the rules, page 3, Supreme Court Rule 20:1.7, and we don't want to dovetail too much into the ethics, that'll be for December, but in this case we talk about what happens when there's a conflict between two current clients. And then it identifies the definition of a concurrent conflict of interest, talking about adverse issues, and then how you can go about representing the parties even if there is this conflict. It's the reasonable belief of the lawyer, no prohibition under the law, which to our knowledge there isn't, There's not a claim by one against the other, so we have to address that with the divorce attorneys. And then informed consent, confirmed in a writing. So informed consent isn't simply, look, I'm going to need this from you, otherwise I can't handle your case. You actually have to go through and talk about the options available and advise independent counsel and suggest that, this is a writing that you have to look at and discuss if you want to go ahead and proceed. But you have to give them informed consent. They have to know what they're signing and why they're signing it to go forward.
Yeah, the most common issue I see with the informed consent is sometimes after talking with a client, they will say, well, does that mean that you have to give my spouse all the info that you have? If we sign a conflict, could I tell you things without you telling my spouse? And the answer is no. that's why it has to be informed consent. What you don't want to have happen is you have parties sign a waiver. The divorce attorneys ask for a copy of all the paperwork, anything you've sent the trustee, copies of tax returns or 1099s, and you give that to both lawyers, and one of the parties gets upset that you did that. And they say, well, I didn't know that you were going to do that when I signed this form. So informed consent is really the key, not just, again, as Ryan put, putting a piece of paper in front of them and saying, just sign this, and then I can stay on the case.
Absolutely. So, I mean, there's a number of options available to the debtors, and we can look at it here. These are just very general fact patterns, so we don't know the income situation of all the debtors here. But for instance, if Hermione's leaving and taking the kids and she has no independent income, then one of her options could be to convert the case or her case to a Chapter 7. Certainly she would have the right to dismiss the case if she doesn't want to be a debtor in bankruptcy anymore. And both of those would be covered under Section 1307 on page 4. She also could consider modification of the plan, and this would be after confirmation, so Section 1329 on page 6, or they could simply just stay in the plan the way it is. There's nothing wrong with it. It's going to pay off all the debt, and frankly, as I mentioned before, it could make the divorce easier to pay off the remaining 8 months or pay it off early if that's a feasible option, get the discharge in bankruptcy, and then debt would no longer be an issue in the divorce.
Yeah, and
if you were going to convert one of the two joint debtors, would that suggest you now need a new bankruptcy lawyer to be involved? Could the same lawyer finish up the 13 with one spouse and do the conversion to 7? Or
I think that as long as the proper informed consent is given, yes, because they're both aiming towards a discharge of debt. It's not like their interests are opposed to one another there. It's just a different means and method of doing it. But again, informed consent would have to be there. Otherwise, you would have to withdraw from both cases and you wouldn't be able to do either one.
Doug, did you have a question?
Since most normally when I see these divorces and a bankruptcy, the expenses double roughly for the family, because they're living separate and they're running two utilities and two rents and blah blah blah. Is the plan going to be feasible anymore? And then what do you do? Withdraw from the case and say, look, you're each going to have to get your own lawyers because, this 13 is not going to work anymore, for example, which is probably true.
So the question for those, in case you couldn't hear it, in the outlying areas is, the expenses could go up if there's two separate households. If that's the case, is the Chapter 13 plan going to be feasible? If it's not, does that then necessitate two independent lawyers to complete the case?
Well, and my answer is sometimes it does make the plan not feasible. Sometimes it still is. It really is a case specific thing. There are plenty of divorced couples who, while living apart, can still manage to pay their bills, and the Chapter 13 plan is just considered to be one of those bills. Family court commissioners a lot of times will assign that debt to one party if the income of one party is much higher than the other, and that will also be taken into account for what type of support is going to be paid to the other spouse. I do think, though, there are plenty of situations where if it's not feasible, and which means you either have to convert to a 7, there are plenty of times where you do need two independent lawyers, especially if the interests can be opposed to one another. This usually happens with secured assets. I have a case where the wife really loves this vehicle that she has. It's a 910 car. It has to be paid in full. And the husband doesn't want to have anything to do with this car. And so for one party, a Chapter 7 would probably be best. For another party, a Chapter 13 would be better in order to kind of keep this car and make it more affordable to her and spread the payments out over 60 planned payments. If the conflict can't be waived, then yeah, I think you need two independent lawyers. And by me meeting with both of them, I may not be able to be the lawyer for either one. You may have to say that you can't be the lawyer for either person, and that's something that debtors' attorneys forget about a lot, is that conflict.
Yes.
Melissa's derails your plan, your program. Skipping ahead, what happens if one of them contacts you 2 years after discharge and says, send me the file, and the other one isn't happy about the file being sent? Does the conflict persist after a successful, apparently, case?
My understanding of the laws for maintaining files is that, number one, it has to be maintained for a certain number of years after the case is concluded. But even with that, typically the client has the right to view and inspect the file and have copies of all relevant documents at any point. I don't think it would be necessary to contact the other party even to give notice of that. I could be wrong on that, but this is, in addition, it's all information that's technically public record. It can be accessed on PACER, minus documents that maybe you've done, like intake forms in the office.
Well, in my office, my policy is that each client has equal access to what's ever in my file. It's in my retainer agreement. My retainer agreement's rather long, but it's in there. Yeah, and I actually spend about a long time going through it. It takes me about 30 minutes to go through it, and because I really want them to understand every part of it. I've seen too many cases where people just sign it without reading it, and then they go back and say, well, their lawyer never told me about this. My policy is anything I send to one client, I send to the other. Both parties have equal access. Anything I send to a trustee, both parties get a copy of that. And I make that very clear at the outset. But leading on to that, which is actually part of the fourth fact pattern that Ryan prepared, is there is sometimes situations where 2 or 3 years after a 7 or 13 is finished, other issues can arise where one party comes back and says, I'm in the middle of a divorce. You represented both of us in a previous Chapter 7 or a 13. Now I would just like you to be my lawyer in a Chapter 7 or a 13. And that is a huge, I think there is a big thing there. I think that you need to have a waiver of some kind for that.
Well, we can flip to that one. It's fact pattern 4. By request, we're changing the names to Don and Peggy Draper. 5 years ago, you had a Chapter 7 with them, so presumably this is still within the time frame for maintaining the files. And then Peggy contacts you and says that she and Don are going through divorce. They each have their own attorneys now. They're taking half of the debt, presumably since the Chapter 7, through the marital settlement agreement. She wants you to represent her and her alone in a Chapter 13 as soon as possible. However, to make matters worse, she doesn't really want to tell anybody what her plans are. So she's got the stated plan in the marital settlement agreement, and she's got her own intent, which she's sharing with you, which she doesn't want to convey to the other lawyer or her soon-to-be ex. And then I think for that to start, we would look at page 3 with 20:1.9, duties to former clients.
Well, and as lawyers know and or should know, that you have an ongoing duty to your former clients. And if you have to represent a new client or an ongoing client where their interests may materially adversely affect a former client, you have an issue there. There's a conflict there, and whether it's waivable or not is also an issue. That may be a type of conflict you cannot waive. This is actually a real fact pattern that happened to me in one of my divorce cases not that long ago. On the eve of signing a MSA, a marital settlement agreement, my client received notice in the mail of a Chapter 13 being filed, which basically made the marital settlement agreement a fraud. She's swearing under oath and presenting to the court that she's going to pay a certain amount of debts, and to sign that knowing that you're not going to, and there was also issues of the stay, the automatic stay. We couldn't get divorced because of that as well. And I actually took real issue with the particular lawyer because he previously had represented both parties in a 7 and in a 13. And I think there was a conflict there that at a minimum should have at least been addressed, and it wasn't. But that's something as a debtor's attorney, you know, you may not always be aware of certain things. I ask a lot of questions anytime I meet with a former client or a new client. My initial consults, my partner thinks they last way too long. She's always on my case, and she's also my mom, so I mean, she's allowed to do that. Right. But, you know, she says, you take forever. Your appointments take, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours. And I say, I want to know everything. There's nothing, because if there is a conflict, if there's any issues, I want to know about it. I don't want to be surprised in the middle of a case. And certain lawyers are fine with that or can handle that. I don't even want to deal with it. I want to know anything and everything. I CCAP every client that comes in. I check everything. I want to know anything that's going on. If wages are about to be garnished, if they're in the middle of a divorce, if they are, who are those attorneys? I will not represent that client without permission to talk to their divorce attorneys, because I don't want to be a part of anything like that. So if you have clients that are in the middle of a divorce, make sure you speak to those divorce lawyers so they know what's going on. And especially if the spouse is a former client as well, there's a conflict there. And it happens more often than I would like to see, where a bankruptcy is filed in the middle of a divorce. The divorce attorneys don't know about it. One of the spouses is not made aware of it prior to it being filed. And in this particular case where the lawyer represented both the husband and the wife previously in a 7 and in a 13, there is a conflict there at a minimum that should have been addressed and waived. It wasn't. Frankly, I left it up to my client to decide what he wanted to do with it, because at that point I'm not a party to that. I made him aware of it, and what he did with it from that point on, I know he really didn't do anything with it, but that is something to at least be made aware of, because he could have. He could have made that a huge point. That lawyer, I don't know if they could have been disqualified. It potentially is an ethical issue.
Yeah, I mean, Rule 1.9 talks about when this conflict arises. And it's, again, it's in a substantially related matter or same matter where the parties' interests are adverse to one another. So if you have, in the case of a divorcing couple, one party who's seeking to discharge their liability, not all liability, you know, child support discharge and probably not student loan discharge, but discharge of certain unsecured debts, and you have another who is ultimately going to be responsible for those if they're marital debts, then I agree with Nathan that you're going to have a conflict. And, you know, we're not trying to say here today that you should drive away business, because we don't want to do that, but when it comes time for that ethical conflict, unlike Rule 1.7, you know, there's not this list of what you need in terms of informed consent. It simply says you shall not represent the party, knowingly represent the party in a similar case whose interests are materially adverse and about whom they acquired prior information that's material to this matter. Depending on how long it's been since the prior bankruptcy, some of the material in the previous bankruptcy may no longer be relevant. But as we know, trustees have broad look-back powers. There's always questions about prior activity in the last 4 years, sometimes in terms of transfers of trust in the last 10 years. So even something where it seems like, oh, well, this material is outdated, it's 2011 income, what relevance does that have to my current situation? It could still be used against the party, at the very least. And then you can't use, you're not supposed to use that information to the disadvantage of the other party. Well, if you're going to go forward and try and disclose assets or to try and leverage those in a way to take care of the debts, then that's certainly going to be a conflict, not to mention potential issues with DSOs.
Right. And in this particular case, there was an issue about, you know, basically one party being responsible for all of the debt while another party was going to discharge it. And there was also an issue about income. In the divorce case, the income was stated as one amount. In the bankruptcy case, it was stated as another amount. And it became a huge thing there. Ultimately, that case did settle, but it added about 5 months, 6 months to the case. That marital settlement agreement had to be thrown out, and we had to draft a completely new one. It cost the parties a lot of money in fees for lawyers and having to go to court more times. That all could have been avoided if, from the outset, that debtor's attorney contacted the divorce attorneys and said, here's what's going on, and the lawyer also contacted his former client as well. We could have worked something out to save the parties a lot of money and a lot of time.
I'm curious to know what your policies are when it comes to couples either coming in initially who are on the verge of a divorce or those who divorce during the middle of a plan. Do any of you have office-wide policies on what you do in these cases? Does anybody just simply refuse to handle them all together and say, if there's a divorce, I'm withdrawing, no questions asked? Or is this going to be looked at on a case-by-case basis? And if so, what safeguards are in place?
Well, going along that line, here's a question which I encounter all the time, which I'm not sure if I'm handling it the right way. I think I am. Oftentimes, my Chapter 13 or even 7 clients will ask me, sometimes even both parties will say, we're going to be getting divorced or separated. Do you have the name of a lawyer that we can see? And that referral, I think, can be an issue. If you refer one spouse to your buddy or divorce attorney who you think is great, you cannot refer then the other spouse to that same lawyer. So where do you send that client? And that's an interesting issue. Lawyers love to throw out names. Lawyers love to give referrals, and that's something that lawyers just love to do, but without thinking about it. And it's a quandary that I've always had is, if I'm referring one spouse to a lawyer who I think's great and another lawyer to another lawyer who I don't even know, they may be great, they may not be great, am I committing an ethical violation there? I don't do that. I generally have two different answers. If both parties come to me, and together will talk to me about it and say, do you have lawyers that we can talk to? I will give them each the same list of names. I have a list of names. I give them each the exact same list. I don't rank them. I don't say, here's who I would hire. But if this person's not available, then I'd hire this person. I just give them a list of names, and then I give them the lawyer referral service with the State Bar. And I generally, I also give kind of general advice because they'll say, well, how do we know who to pick? I give the same general advice I'd give to anybody about choosing a lawyer. I don't know if that's the right way to handle it. Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
We're not holding everyone to this. We understand, you know, this is a question for Tim Pierce or Aviva at the State Bar, but any thoughts on how to go about doing the referrals or to handle those cases?
Yeah, I've got one kind of thought about that. I took the policy actually less. I'm usually just telling people I can't be involved because of this conflict. And one client called me in hysterics one night about the divorce and really, really wanted a referral and I didn't give it, which I still think was the right thing, but where I could result sometimes next month. I don't think it was my refusal to refer. On the other hand, it's a little too close for comfort.
Right, and I'm pretty... I'm sure you know there are probably some previous existing mental health issues, but that's a tough one for me because you know there's times where somebody really needs a lawyer, and as a lawyer, you want to see that person get the assistance that they need, and it's a tough one for me as well. I have a really tough time with it. That's why the first thing I do is. If I don't get a conflict waiver, it's really tough. I try to talk about waiving a conflict, and what I really try to send both clients the same list of names if I can. It's really hard, though, if you're in a situation where you just can't do it.
Why don't you send him to the lawyer referral service at the State Bar? I mean, we pay these State Bar dues. We've got to be a member of it. This is a service they provide. Why isn't that the answer? Send him, you know, you're not... All you're doing is saying, this is somebody who keeps a list of people who specialize in this area, they'll be able to help you.
This is California, and I'm not sure they have that service, but sometimes those things are so difficult to access. I think maybe, I really don't know, sometimes it seems like you appear to be giving help, but you're not really.
Well, and that's generally what I do. If both parties don't come to me and both kind of have this united front of, you know, we both would like a list of names, I always send them to the lawyer referral service from the State Bar. I talk it up quite a bit. I say, look, I'm not just pushing you off because I don't want to give you an answer. There's legal reasons why I can't. I strongly encourage them to use it. I say it's they're there to help. They'll get you in touch with several names, go see the names that they give you, and actually my policy is if I refer one client to the lawyer referral service, I will send a letter to the other client saying the exact same thing. My big thing is I don't ever want to be accused of favoring one client over another, and in a divorce situation that's really tough. I have a lot of divorce attorneys who send clients who are going through a divorce to me, and that's tough to do to remain. Both parties will want to tell you about their divorce, and sometimes look for free advice, and you just can't do it. And my policy is I won't talk about it. At most, I will talk about procedure only as it relates to the potential Chapter 7 or a 13. There's a mandatory 120-day waiting period when you file for a divorce. I'm not telling anything the clients at that point anything that they can't look up on Google. So I will explain that and explain how with the automatic stay we can get relief from the stay in that time period, and so that the divorce can move along in a timely fashion if they're ready at that point. That's about as much as I'll go into it. And so it's tough because I get a lot of referrals from divorce attorneys to do Chapter 7s or 13s. Sometimes one party needs to be in a 7, one party needs to be in a 13. And I'm pretty hard on the divorce lawyers, too, as to explaining. I want the divorce lawyers to explain the potential conflict, and I explain it, and really keep them informed. That's really the key there. And I make them well aware that even if they're going through a divorce, if I'm going to represent them and they're informed and they're willing to sign the consent and the waiver of the conflict, my policies stay the same. Anything that I send to the trustee, both parties get a copy of. I'm not going to deviate from that. So if one party says, here are my pay stubs, send to the trustee, but don't give them to my spouse, I won't do that. And I bring those examples up right at the beginning. If that's a party for, if that's a problem for one of the parties, I'm out. I won't deal with it. I know that business is tough to get these days, but it's just not worth the headache to me.
Wisconsin may be a little unique because we are a mandatory bar, and so we have that service. If that fails, I know, for instance, in Illinois, if someone had decided to move down to Lake County or to Chicago, the local bar associations might also be a resource with the same idea of a list. At the very least, they can contact administrators and see if there's a list of available attorneys by practice area. Typically, family law attorneys will be perfectly fine to be on the local bars, given that it's such a referral-based system.
Right.
So that would be available. And that's available, too, in Milwaukee and some other counties here, too, as long as the counties are big enough to support the bar associations.
And I do want to put in a plug just for anybody that's not bankruptcy, keep doing bankruptcy 100% of the time, that we do have a form stipulation and order, so that if the parties are in a Chapter 13, or one party, is in a Chapter 13 and they want a divorce, or a Chapter 7, you can stipulate to relief from stay. The judge will sign the order. You don't have to go through a big notice or contested, have a hearing or anything like that. You can stipulate that the stay should be lifted so that the divorce can go forward. And that form is available. We like you to use the form. We don't like you to invent something that's specific to your case. This seems to work just fine. And I encourage everybody that encounters this to look for that form, have the party sign it or the lawyer sign it, and get it on, and we'll get you your order lifting the stay so that the divorce can continue.
Absolutely. It's very easy to find on the court website. And best of all, I'm sure the divorce judge will be very happy to know that, with the exception of the assets being divided, that the divorce can go on and we don't have to worry about this stay that they don't really understand.
Yeah, and I actually use the form that's on the website just because I like to give judges exactly whatever they want. I don't try to reinvent the wheel, or if a judge says, this is what we want, that's great. I love that because it makes life really easy for me. Along those lines, one issue that I have seen, not often, but every once in a while, and I think this goes to conflicts that cannot be waived, is I have seen a case, and it wasn't me, it was a colleague of mine who then called me because he didn't know what to do, where the parties wanted, they were in the middle of a Chapter 13, they just wanted to finish the plan, they were doing a divorce pro se, they had no problem signing a conflict waiver to finish the plan. The plan didn't have that much further to go and have the attorney continue on. The issue arose is that they asked if he could help them fill out the pro se forms for the divorce, and they were willing to sign any waiver. And I think that is a conflict that you can't waive. In my opinion, you can't represent both the, even if they're both, if they're joint petitioners in a divorce, I don't think that's a conflict you can waive. Now, there are some divorce attorneys that will act as one attorney for both parties. I have just a personal disagreement with that. I don't think that you can ethically do that. But there are divorce attorneys that will. I mean, their opinion is just different than mine. I don't know how you can equally represent both parties' interests when, at least at some level, they are opposed. But that was an interesting question my colleague had, is could he just help them fill out the pro se forms? It was about the most amicable, it was a very amicable divorce, clearly. I told him no. I said, I don't think you can, even with a waiver. I said you'd have to send them to, they have a help desk at the state courthouse, and I said, I think you'll have to send them there, and they'll help them fill out the forms. That's why that exists. It's not worth putting yourself in a situation where, even if it's highly unlikely either party would complain about it later, I wouldn't even risk it. So just keep in mind, not all conflicts can be waived.
Could both parties go to the courthouse and together fill out the documents pro se, or would they have to go individually?
It's actually common where both parties will. As the help desk at the state courthouse is not their lawyer, they're not acting as an advocate for either party, there's not an issue there. You know, if the question is what goes on line B, the help desk doesn't have a problem explaining that.
Yeah, my understanding is that help desk, especially the pro se help desk here at the bankruptcy court, we're allowed to, you know, ghostwrite these documents, fill them in for them, to make sure they're complete and accurate. Ultimately, you know, the parties volunteering aren't going to be called into the 341 meeting to certify that the documents are accurate. It's going to be the debtor's own testimony, but I guess the same thing would apply with the joint divorce petition. If we want to move to hypothetical two, we have clients now in a smaller, a shorter Chapter 13 plan, 36 months, paying nothing to unsecured creditors. It's been confirmed and things are going well. They're actually in the Triple M program, a good plug for the program, working well to try and get a loan modification on their house and save it from foreclosure. Ultimately, however, they meet and they say, we want a divorce and we want to know what we can do. The husband says, I want to keep the house, pass it along to the son in the future. And the wife says, I don't like the son, I don't trust him for good reason, and we should just let the house go and start fresh. Well, now you've got a clear conflict in terms of goals. What do you do with them? Anybody want to take this one on? Shaking their head. Send them out to other attorneys or handle one but not the other, advise them both. They're your current clients, so I mean, you have to give them some sort of guidance. What would you do in this case? Doug?
I think you're best off to send them both out and give them a list of 3-4 competent bankruptcy practitioners, mm-hmm. and say, because I just can't see that you now have acquired confidential knowledge between the two of them and you may be using it, you know, in one proceeding or the other, one way or the other, and you're going to become an advocate for either keeping the house or getting rid of the house, right?
Well, suppose the husband wants to keep the house and stay in the Chapter 13, is willing to do so, pay the mortgage payment, pay the nominal Chapter 13 payment, and try and get the loan ultimately in his name alone. And the wife says, absolutely not, I'm filing a Chapter 7, I want this case severed, I want to convert my side of it to Chapter 7. Does that still stand, or do you think that you can represent one of the parties, or both, or neither?
Well, I can tell you, I've had a situation like that, and again, as long as, you know, both parties agree, you know, the wife can discharge any liability on the mm-hmm. home. And if he wants to then proceed and keep it and stay in the 13, he can do that. One question I don't know the answer to is whether the mortgage company will allow a modification with only one of the debtors signing the paperwork. I think that's a creditor-specific thing. Some lenders may, some lenders may not, and that also may be something to look into. She's not going to be willing to sign a modification and reaffirm her debt on that house if she wants to just let it go. If he can do it without her having to sign the loan modification or reaffirming, or her without reaffirming the debt, I think you could, as long as the proper informed consents are signed and waivers, you could stay on as both and have one in a 13 and one in a 7. The issue is going to be is if the mortgage company requires both debtors to sign all the paperwork, and frankly, I don't know the answer to that question. I think it depends on each, it's a case-by-case thing.
Yeah, we don't have Jay or Shannon here to answer that or at least kind of give some guidance on that, but when the debtors are in trial period plans, usually when they sign the permanent modifications, they have to certify that the information that they've previously provided is the same, or if it's not, they have a duty to update them, just like they would have a duty to update the Chapter 13 trustee if something material changed with their income. So in this case, and this is not something you can control, if the parties are absolutely certain they're splitting and they try and go through with this, they're going to run into a problem with the mortgage company if they get the modification and then it just falls apart because financially it doesn't work out and they end up going into a Chapter 7. It would probably be a suggestion of bad faith that they go ahead and get the loan modification signed, everything's back in place, and they immediately default again.
Yeah, I mean, my big concern would be, as Doug said, they each have different goals, mm-hmm. and if you as an attorney cannot adequately meet those goals while still asserting both of their interests on the same level, then yeah, you would have to refer them to different lawyers. I think it would depend on whether a creditor would be willing to allow the mortgage modification to go through with only one of the debtors signing.
Well, then going along with that, in hypothetical three, the fact patterns change just a little bit because you're coming in at the initial consultation and the debtors are saying, we want you to tell us what to do. We promise, because of course the debtor's going to promise to listen to you and to follow along with your advice. So you have a case where you're borderline not passing the means test, so it looks like a Chapter 13 plan, perhaps. They could pass the test, but then they've announced to you, we're not planning to stay together. Well, if that's the case then, do you even want to go forward and try a Chapter 13? Is there a way to get the debtors into Chapter 7 or, I suppose, Chapter 11? Or is there some other alternative to where that they can handle their debt? Because there's pretty substantial debt here, unsecured priority as well. So the debt's going to have to be taken care of one way or the other, through a bankruptcy or paid after the divorce is completed. What do you think about separate households?
Well, and that's a case that's pretty common. Usually the debtors end up in separate households. As Doug Mann pointed out, the expenses go way up. It costs a lot more money to support two households on the same amount of income than it does one. A lot of people file for divorce thinking they're going to save money. I tell them that's absolutely not the case because it's common where one spouse will hire me as a divorce attorney and says, my wife spends a ton of money or my husband spends a ton of money. I need to sever my ties to save my money. And I go, well, you're now supporting two households on the same finite amount of money. So in one sense, you may be saving money. In one sense, you may be spending a lot more as a family unit. This is a case where there may be a rebuttable presumption that you can put forth to the U.S. Trustee's office, because each party would probably, or there's a likelihood that each party may qualify in their own seven, given that the expenses are going to go way up and their incomes are going to go down. I've had cases where due to support that's being paid from one party to the other, they each on their own would qualify for a seven. And so it's a situation where they probably could do a seven, especially if you can show that that they would each qualify on their own, they could probably file together and file a rebuttable presumption.
I think I had a case similar to this where the second household expenses were considered special circumstances.
Right.
And there was a statement in the record that these people should not stay in the same household, that it was not a healthy situation. They had to be in the two separate households for the benefit of the child. And I had no trouble finding that with special circumstances and giving them the extra expenses, which then let them file the seven rather than stick them in a 13 and try to make payments. But this leads to the perennial question. Is it always better to file the bankruptcy before the divorce if they can time it that way? Because then they don't have... If they can qualify for the seven, then they don't have to worry about the credit card debt, the medical bills, et cetera,
right,
trying to split that up and fighting about that. It would seem to me it would almost always be better, but are there other considerations?
I take it as a case-by-case basis. Sometimes it is better to wait till after the divorce is filed, as long as I like to have everything ready to go. So once the divorce is filed, we can right away get the Chapter 7 filed and hopefully finish it, or get relief from the stay before that mandatory 120-day waiting period is up. I'm very conscious of not delaying the divorce in any way, because that costs more money and attorney fees for each party. There are situations where it's better to wait. I think that a lot of people are not living in separate households prior to the divorce being filed, and then after the divorce is being filed, a family court commissioner will set temporary orders and order each of them to maintain their own expenses. It may make it easier with the trustee's office, with a rebuttable presumption that that they are living in two separate households at that time. I don't know how they would take the view of, well, we plan on filing for divorce and we plan on living in separate households. I would rather have that set in place sometimes. But there are times where we do file prior. I take it, it's a case-by-case issue. Depends on each set of facts.
Well, you have a risk if you wait until after the divorce is completed and one party files and the other either is not eligible for a bankruptcy, or I should say for a discharge, or is just flat out opposed to bankruptcy in principle, then the non-filing ex-spouse now, is going to have an issue, because the divorce decree has probably split the debt in two, 50-50. Well, if now a creditor decides to come after them, not caring about the divorce or about what the MSA says, then you're now triggering a hold harmless clause, and you've got potential litigation by the ex-spouse and bad blood coming back.
Well, and it's important, and I know it's hard for, as debtors' attorneys, a lot of these cases are flat fee. You're not paid by the hour. You don't want to make calls that you don't need to make. Call the divorce attorneys. Communicate with them. Get on the same page. One, they're going to have a ton of questions. As a general rule, divorce attorneys know nothing about this stuff. I was shocked how little they know when I started taking on those cases. So at a minimum, call those lawyers. A lot of times there's language they can put in that I've used in my own cases, where you know the parties can testify and swear that it's their intention to file a Chapter 7, that they will each not hold the other one responsible for any debt. There are times where I myself feel uncomfortable representing both parties in a case if I feel one client's not exactly being honest or open about their assets or income. That's an interesting situation too, where they may both be willing to sign a waiver. I get the impression that somebody is not being forthcoming, or they have in confidence told me that they're not being forthcoming. At that point, you have a real issue as well. And that has happened to me too. I get out of that case so quick. I withdraw as quickly as I can, or tell them each, I'm not getting involved with this. And that's it. But that does happen. Because in divorce situations, it's very tough. Somebody may not be forthcoming about their income for support purposes, but in a Chapter 7 or 13, you have to be open and honest about all income. You know, you have to testify under oath, under the penalty of perjury. You know, have you disclosed all of your income? You have income from any other sources. And that's open for either party to hear. And you may be in a conflict that you can't waive at that point, or that you shouldn't even try to waive. Just because you can waive a conflict doesn't mean you should. So there are times you should just get out of a case. And that generally sends a signal also to the divorce attorneys. So.
Great. Unless there are any questions? Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ryan. I'm going to try my best to get us an ethics credit for this hour, because I think it was really focused on conflicts and ethical questions. So everybody that's like me and is always looking for that extra ethics credit, stay tuned and we'll put it on the website if we're able to secure that. But we definitely appreciate all that good information. August 11th is our next meeting. That's on Chapter 13 Hot Topics with our trustees. And then November 3rd for the Supreme
judges
Court, and December 8th for
request
ethics
a copy
and
the bankruptcy schedules.
Thank you again.
I've never had a judge ask that.